Britain emerged from World War II with a profound sense of exceptionalism. While continental nations embraced European integration as salvation from the ashes of defeat, Britain viewed it as an admission of weakness. How could the liberator of Europe need to join hands with those it had saved? This tension between Britain's imperial self-image and the reality of its declining power forms the heart of Britain's troubled European journey, a 50-year struggle between pragmatic necessity and emotional resistance that continues to shape British politics today. The war left Britain economically wounded, but psychologically triumphant. Despite losing a quarter of its national wealth, British exports quickly recovered to 5 times those of France. This economic resilience reinforced the widespread belief that victory had increased rather than diminished the nation's strength, a delusion that would prove costly in the decades to come. Winston Churchill embodied Britain's fundamental European contradiction. As early as 1930, he advocated for a United States of Europe to resolve Franco-German hostility. After his 1945 electoral defeat, European unity became his great opposition cause, culminating in his 1946 Zurich speech calling for a United States of Europe built around Franco-German partnership. Yet Churchill's vision contained a fatal flaw. Britain would be with Europe, but not of it. While proposing European unity, he positioned Britain outside this construct, as a godmother whose relationship resembled America's. At the 1948 Congress of Europe, Churchill spoke eloquently about forgetting hatreds and effacing frontiers, yet never imagined including Britain in any sovereignty pooling arrangement. This ambiguity established the pattern for British European policy. Continental leaders embraced Churchill's rhetoric without recognizing its contradictions, like believing someone who enthusiastically designs your house while making clear they'd never live in it themselves. On May 9, 1950, French Foreign Minister Robert Schuman announced a revolutionary plan. France and Germany would place their coal and steel industries under a shared high authority to which both nations would surrender sovereignty. Britain's response revealed its fundamental reluctance. Jean Monnet, the plan's architect, insisted the treaty must be signed as a matter of principle before details were decided, requiring the surrender of national sovereignty over a wide strategic and economic field, a precondition intolerable to British officials. The cabinet's rejection came in pathetic circumstances, with Foreign Secretary Bevin hospitalized, Prime Minister Attlee on holiday, and Herbert Morrison declaring, "It's no good, we can't do it. The Durham miners will never wear it." This decision cost Britain its post-war European leadership. 9 months later, the European Coal and Steel Community formed, with Jean Monnet at its head, and Britain on the outside looking in. When European integration expanded beyond coal and steel, Britain shifted from domination to alarm. The 1955 Messina Conference outlined plans for a united Europe through common institutions, merged economies, and harmonized social policies. Britain sent Russell Bretherton, a middle-ranking official, while other nations sent top diplomats, symbolizing Britain's diminishing engagement. Bretherton faced the quintessential dilemma of Britain's European relationship. Active engagement implied commitment, while silence allowed unpleasant proposals to advance. His instructions from London ensured no real leverage, telling him not to imply that we would join if our points were met. R.A. Butler later admitted Britain's mistake with surprising casualness. "I wasn't blamed at the time at all, and I have not been blamed very much in history," revealing London's fundamental disinterest in European integration. Despite British obstruction, the Treaty of Rome establishing the European Economic Community was signed in March 1957. By December 1959, Harold Macmillan acknowledged the painful reality. For the first time since the Napoleonic era, the major continental powers are united, which may have the effect of excluding us both from European markets and from consultation in European policy. Britain's European conversion began with economics, not politics. A contradictory formula emerged, insisting membership was essential while claiming nothing in British governance would change. Macmillan's July 1961 announcement to Parliament about seeking membership emphasized negatives over positives, dismissing sovereignty as perhaps a matter of degree. This reluctant courtship would be rejected by de Gaulle's no in 1963, delaying Britain's entry by another decade. Edward Heath stands as the pivotal figure in Britain's European story. Unlike Macmillan's anguish or Wilson's dissembling, Heath possessed a vision of blinding clarity where all paths led to European integration. His governance was exemplary, resulting in the complete achievement of his political objective. The negotiations beginning July 1970 were paradoxical. Though immensely complex, they remained secondary to the fundamental imperative that Britain must join Europe to restore our position at the center of European affairs. Britain faced some 13,000 pages of European law, with the community's principle being swallow the lot. The Pompidou Heath summit in May 1971 secured British entry. The leaders settled everything in 12 hours of private talks, with Pompidou declaring it would be unreasonable now to believe that an agreement is not possible. Heath later called it one of the greatest moments of my life. On January 1, 1973, Britain finally joined the European Community, 23 years after the Schuman Plan. For 11 years, Margaret Thatcher embodied a fundamental contradiction in Britain's European relationship. She advanced European integration more than anyone since Heath, while simultaneously fueling opposition to it. Her cabinet secretary noted her unique combination of anti-European rhetoric with pragmatic pro-European policies. Thatcher's crowning European achievement was the 1986 Single European Act, which created a genuine single market. Yet she failed to recognize this would inevitably require the European regulation and majority voting she would later oppose. By 1988, her rhetoric had hardened significantly. Her Bruges speech, warning against a European superstate exercising a new dominance from Brussels, established her as the champion of Euroscepticism, despite containing positive references to European cooperation. Thatcher's contradictory legacy, advancing European integration through the single market while providing the intellectual foundation for opposing further integration, would haunt her successors and ultimately contribute to Britain's exit from the European Union she had helped shape. Britain's European journey reveals a nation struggling to reconcile past greatness with present realities. For 50 years, British leaders performed an elaborate dance, stepping toward Europe when economic necessity demanded it, pulling back when sovereignty seemed threatened. This ambivalence prevented Britain from fully shaping the continent's future from within. The tragedy lies not in Britain joining too late, but joining without conviction. While continental nations built a European project with emotional investment, Britain approached it as a transactional arrangement to be constantly renegotiated. The result was a relationship that satisfied neither the British public nor European partners. Perhaps the most important lesson is that great nations cannot live on past glories. Britain's reluctance to embrace its European future stemmed from an inability to let go of its imperial self-image. Only by confronting both its diminished global position and its inescapable European geography can Britain find its place in the post-imperial world.